The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, and it's read by John Federson. Today's issue is dated December the 8th of 2022. And for anyone interested, our exciting theme music is performed this week by the same people who performed last week, and I hope you enjoy it. And as we usually comment on, IndieWeek.com is an online source that has a few more later dated articles than our print issue, so we'll read from both today. And we'll start online from IndieWeek.com concerning an incident that has reached a national audience, news audiences, and it's the destruction of Moore County substations. On Saturday evening, Moore County law enforcement responded to calls that the substations had been heavily damaged by multiple rounds of gunfire and power had gone out through most of the area. Those responsible for shooting up two Duke Energy substations, cutting off electricity to more than 40,000 people, could face decades in prison if apprehended and convicted. Destroying or conspiring to destroy an energy facility like a substation carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison if the damage exceeds $100,000 or causes a significant interruption or impairment of a function. If convicted, the perpetrators could also be fined up to $50,000 on each count. However, if someone dies as a result of the act, like a home oxygen supply running out, the penalty is life in prison. On Saturday evening, Moore County law enforcement responded to calls that the substations had been heavily damaged by multiple rounds of gunfire and power had gone out through most of the area. Duke Energy reported that it could be Thursday today, when I'm broadcasting this, before the substations are repaired and power restored. The utility has not provided a full cost estimate of the damage, but media accounts quoted Moore County Sheriff Ronnie Fields as saying it is likely in the millions of dollars. Between the two substations, West End and Carthage, is roughly a 15-minute drive. The outages occurred roughly 45 minutes apart, according to the local newspaper, The Pilot. Police have not publicly identified a motive, although the FBI and SBI have joined the investigation. Around the same time of the shootings at those substations, protesters were demonstrating against a drag show at the Sunrise Theater in Southern Pines. The show continued for about an hour by candlelight, according to a tweet. Sheriff Fields said in a press conference, investigators have not tied the destruction to any opposition to the drag show. However, Emily Grace Rennie, a far-right activist and vehement opponent of the event, posted on Facebook, telling her followers, "You know what to do," WRAL reported. Rennie also posted on Twitter that she knew why the power went out. Sheriff Fields said during a press conference that he visited Rennie, asked her several questions, and, quote, had a word of prayer with her, but determined using, quote, good law enforcement, that she was not responsible. It's difficult to know what to make of Rainey's social media posts. Her Instagram feed is rife with anti-vaxxer, hardline Catholic, and prepper posts. Examples: worship God, rebuild his kingdom, and when required, use force to defend it. She's also trained in military psychological operations, which specializes in the sowing of information and disinformation against American adversaries. Rennie resigned from the U.S. Army last year when she had attained the rank of captain after receiving a reprimand for a protest near Fort Bragg, according to CBS News. She subsequently led 100 people to the January 6th rally-turned-riot outside the U.S. Capitol, but has not been charged with entering the building. If those responsible for taking down the Moore County power grid did so to disrupt the drag show, it's possible that could meet the definition of domestic terrorism under the USA Patriot Act. It defines domestic terrorism as acts that, quote, that intend to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, influence the policy of a government through intimidation or coercion, or affect the conduct of a government through mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. Convictions on domestic terrorism charges could carry additional penalties if prosecutors choose to pursue them. Although Congress did not pass a 2019 bill strengthening these penalties, Christina Kress, a North Carolina energy lawyer, noted on Twitter that, quote, three men in Ohio pleaded guilty to crimes related to plotting attack on U.S. power grids in furtherance of white supremacist ideology. They were charged with conspiracy to provide material support to terrorists in violation, were sentenced to 15 years in federal prison, lifetime supervised release, a $250,000 fine, and forfeiture of all property seized during the investigation of the case. Next, from IndyWeek.com, glimmers of hope at UNC Clinic. It was first published, this story, on North Carolina Health News. Tony Marks in Pinehurst and Brooke Keaton in Charlotte both lived orderly, productive lives 2 years ago. That was clearly reflected in their steady jobs and close family ties. However, their experiences with the long-term effects of infection with COVID-19 virus have touched and in many cases devastated neither every other aspect of each of their days. Marks and Keaton don't know each other, but both have worked with John Barata, who practices physical medicine and rehabilitation at UNC COVID Recovery Clinic. There, Barata and his colleagues attempt to explore several paths out of these lingering, disabling after effects of the pandemic. Marks, a 55-year-old software executive, said during a physical therapy at that clinic, I haven't had a day in over a year and a half that I have not hurt, that I haven't been tired, that my hands just don't feel like they have arthritis. I just can't explain how bad I just physically hurt on a day-to-day basis, and there's the fatigue, so I know there's got to be something else, right? And that's why I want to do this so badly. As Marks battles the lingering effects of COVID, he faces unpredictable limits on his working days. Keaton struggles with her symptoms so much that she lost her job as a preschool teacher. However, in the larger picture emerging from the UNC clinic and others, there are signs that help may be on the way for the patients known as COVID long haulers, aid, in the form of new research, promising treatments, and evolving approaches to therapy. Approaches monitored at the UNC clinic include new, hard science about microclots that may lie at the heart of some of long COVID's symptoms, a potentially game-changing analysis introduced by a South African researcher, Rezia Pretorius. Barata explained during a Chapel Hill interview, her lab has demonstrated that there are circulating microclots in the blood of many people with long COVID. These clots don't necessarily block blood vessels causing stroke or heart attack. What they do is they trap inflammatory molecules and they prevent the breakdown of some of the inflammation. So, these circulating microclots can cause this persistent inflammatory process. And they've actually, in some early clinical research, been trying to anticoagulate patients in an attempt to break down the microclots, and some of their early data suggests favorable results. The theory of microclots' role in the disease has created excitement as an example of a new direction. Even though Pretorius' findings were based on a relatively small sample of patients, and separate research found lower levels of microclotting in the vessels of other long COVID patients. It's too early to know whether Pretorius' findings will be replicated on a large scale, Barata said, but her findings show the kind of progress that will be necessary to advance the treatment of long COVID. known internationally before her research on COVID, Pretorius gave the keynote speech at a symposium on approaches to long COVID presented by UNC in Greensboro last May. Closer to home, therapists at the clinic give advice to patients on rationing their energy by comparing it to a balance on a credit card, a finite amount that must be carefully monitored lest it fall into a steep deficit. Clinic staffer Courtney Maternick, who holds a doctorate in physical therapy, explained the theory about pacing to Marks during a visit to the Chapel Hill Clinic. She told him that he will exhaust his energy balance more quickly as a COVID long hauler, saying, "Every morning you're waking up and getting $100. It may not feel like you're getting $100, but you're getting this $100. But you're using more. So now you're in a deficit, right? So the next morning, and this is just super simplified, you have $100 and you use $150. You're in a $50 deficit already. Then the next day you wake up, you don't even have the energy to pay off that bill, but you still have to survive, eat, do everything, but you feel like, I can't get out of bed. And that's because you literally have used everything." Matrunik said that's often when a COVID patient ends up needing to stay in bed for a couple of days to catch up. Researcher Pretorius asserts some clinicians have made incorrect diagnoses in cases of long COVID because most tests don't pick up on the presence of inflammation hidden within the microclots that she's studying. She said during a video interview, "Many people feel that they go to a clinician and they are misdiagnosed. Many of the typical laboratory blood type analyses will not pick up any difference in inflammatory markers. And the patient has become very desperate as the condition is ascribed to a psychological issue." In her research, two infusions of an anticoagulant drug succeeded in dissolving the microclots. This allowed treatment of the inflammation that can cause damage to blood vessels and prevent oxygen from reaching cells. And Pretorius said, "If you look at the long COVID symptoms closely, it all comes back to hypoxia of certain organ systems, whether it's the muscle not getting enough oxygen, whether it's liver damage, whether it's brain fog, concentration issues. One can all bring it back to a reason why the symptoms might appear because of oxygen deprivation to certain areas." Keaton, now 42, had been a go-to teacher, mom to two girls, a wife, and someone deeply involved in church with a broad community of family and friends when she was diagnosed with COVID in December of 2020. "I was a fun teacher," she said. "They knew I played music, and I would say, 'We will dance. We will have a party on the playground.' And now I can't even walk down the steps down to my kitchen without becoming short of breath. Even now, having this conversation with you, I feel myself being short of breath." During a phone call from Charlotte, Keaton told of how missed diagnoses caused problems in her now years-long effort to address these post-acute COVID symptoms. She said she's heard of similar experiences during online discussion as part of a group of black women facing long COVID. She described an attempt to steer her on an unproductive path by a doctor who seemed determined to act on a particular diagnosis. She said, "I went in explaining to her the fatigue, memory loss, brain fog, issue with numbness in my hands and feet, and feeling vibrations. And she looked at me and she's like, 'I think we need to test you for sleep apnea. Has that ever been a concern?'" Now, researchers have found a high incidence of undiagnosed sleep apnea in African Americans, but Keaton pointed out her husband could attest to the fact she didn't even snore. She went on to say, "And her, the whole thing was like, 'I think all of this is because you have sleep apnea.' So Keaton spent money on testing at home and at the physician's office, both of which indicated she did not have sleep apnea." Quote, "And she just kind of left it there. I'm like, so we determined I don't have apnea. What can we do about everything else? In response, the physician gave her pointers on how to get better sleep at night. So, fast forward, she continued. Where's the part where you apologize to me for making an assumption, you know? Adding insult to the entire process, Keaton found her insurance coverage did not cover certain treatments and therapies that were otherwise recommended. Another direction for the clinic involves examining the overlap between long COVID and myalgic encephalomyelitis, also called chronic fatigue syndrome, abbreviated as MECFS. It shares a similarity with long COVID in that doctors sometimes overlook or minimize its symptoms. Barata said, about 20% of long haulers may also develop chronic fatigue. MECFS is a syndrome which has been recognized for many decades, said Barata. It is thought to, in most cases, be post-viral or post-infectious in nature, and many people with MECFS have had difficulty getting their symptoms and the syndrome recognized in the medical community. Examining the reasons that chronic fatigue is sometimes undiagnosed could reveal similar issues with recognition of long COVID. For one thing, many physicians are not trained to recognize these types of post-infectious disease fatiguing illnesses. Barata said, so it's not really on our radar when we evaluate patients. The cases are not seen with great regularity, and that can also make it less likely for a doctor to think of it as a diagnosis. And the subjective nature of the symptoms of the linked diseases also comes into play. For example, he said, someone might come into the office and say, I'm fatigued, I feel like I don't have as much energy, I'm not thinking as clearly as I used to. These are not as easy to diagnose issues as a heart murmur, where you can listen with a stethoscope and the doctor can clearly hear with their own ears. In addition, said Barata, a clinician may think a patient is malingering or has an agenda, such as an attempt to gain disability coverage. The range and profundity of conditions that accompany long COVID, intense fatigue, difficulty in concentration, chronic pain, shortness of breath, make faking it seem unlikely. Another direction for the clinic involves examining the overlap between long COVID and myalgic encephalomyelitis. Oh, I've already read this. About 20% of long haulers may also develop chronic fatigue. A longtime professional, Marx, sounds distraught and unbelieving when he describes his attempts to keep working. He said, I crash every day at work. And he said, there's no rhyme or reason as to the time it could be, first thing in the morning or in mid-afternoon. He went on, and when I crash, I sleep, and I'm asleep anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours. Can you imagine being asleep for 2 hours at work? And I'm sleeping so hard, and my neighbors in other offices are saying, dude, you slept good because you were snoring like a freight train. He said that if he's honest with himself, he really can only get in 4 hours of work during an 8-hour workday. For Keaton, her case of long COVID has meant not only the physical and mental symptoms, but also losing her job, needing to replace her work-related insurance, and chipping away at her typical role as caretaker and problem solver. And she choked up briefly when talking about her change in personal status. I've always been a positive person. I had a rough time growing up in certain situations with my parents. I'm just a fighter. I know that I'm going to get better. I have faith that I'm going to get better. I know there's a reason for me going through this, and before long, you know, God will reveal it. Well, despite the potential of multiple research efforts, there remains no set treatment or protocol to treat the condition. Some patients at Barata's clinic may receive medication. Some are prescribed therapy, and others are given suggestions about modifying their levels of activity. to the print issue of the Independent Now, Indie Week, a consequential case. And this is a case we've all been hearing about on the national news at the Supreme Court of the United States. After fending off, Jasmine Gallup writes, after fending off Republican-dominated state legislature for more than a decade, voting rights advocates are arguing their case before the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday. Moore versus Harper, a North Carolina case that was appealed to the nation's highest court earlier this year, is the culmination of a more than 10-year battle over voting rights, particularly the rights of black and brown voters. It's a battle to make your vote count. Back in 2011, when Republicans took control of the state legislature, they immediately began the process of gerrymandering, that is, drawing the boundaries of electoral districts in favor of their own political party, so they could stay in power. Allison Riggs, co-executive director and chief counsel for voting rights at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, SCSJ, says, they drew districts that packed in as many black voters into as few districts as possible, limiting their political power. Riggs is one of the lawyers arguing in favor of voters before the Supreme Court this week. Going on, the legislature was drawing these district lines based on race and then also creating partisan gerrymanders, districts that would not be responsible to the political will of North Carolina voters. The unfair voting map North Carolina Republicans approved was just the first law of many that would be challenged in court. Over the next 10 years, Republicans continued to try to pass racial and partisan gerrymandering plans, most of which were struck down after challenges from SCSJ and other voting rights groups. In 2013, North Carolina legislators passed a law that would have, quote, cut early voting, eliminated precinct voting, and placed restrictive ID requirements, says Tyler Day, policy and chief engagement manager of Common Cause NC. The effort, which would have widely disenfranchised black and brown voters, made national headlines. A three-judge federal appeals panel in 2016 struck down the law, calling it, quote, the most restrictive voting law North Carolina has seen since the era of Jim Crow, and one that targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. The movement to enact voting restrictions, making it harder to vote early, by mail, or vote at all if you were in a minority, surged after the 2020 presidential election, with extreme conservatives crying voter fraud as Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump. Day says these are the kinds of laws, ones that disproportionately affect young voters and voters of color, the Republicans could bring back if they win in the Moore versus Harper case. And the question is, would there be a check on the state legislature's power? This case is really, truly vital to our democracy. It's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's about all of our voting rights. No single branch of government should have unchecked power. One reason Moore versus Harper is getting so much attention is that it's different from the redistricting cases that have been argued in North Carolina before. Unlike previous cases, Moore doesn't address a single voting map or law. Instead, it covers the wider question of how much autonomy state legislatures should have over redistricting and election laws. Day says it goes beyond just redistricting. We could be talking about federal elections law. Last year, following the decennial census, the battle over redistricting again came into the spotlight. The Republican-led legislature passed gerrymandered voting maps. SCSJ challenged them in court. Voting rights advocates won that case in the NC Supreme Court, but, unlike with previous cases, their battle didn't stop there. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court voted to take up the case, despite a previous ruling in 2019 saying partisan gerrymandering should be handled by state courts. And Republicans are taking full advantage of the opportunity to make their case heard before the nation's nine judges. In Moore, the North Carolina GOP argues that state lawmakers should have almost complete power over elections. They argue state courts have no constitutional authority to strike down election laws and impose new ones, as they have in the past. Day adds, that is what is so concerning, because if state legislatures have that sort of unchecked power, you're giving a significant amount of power to one branch. No matter what party you're a part of, you don't want one party to have that type of unfettered power. The Republican argument is founded on the independent state legislature theory. That's a belief that state legislatures, and only the legislatures, have the power to regulate federal elections in their state, irrespective of constraints imposed by state constitutions or the efforts of state courts to enforce state laws, says Asher Hildebrand. He's an associate professor at Duke University School of Public Policy. This radical theory, he goes on, has no basis in history, no basis in legal precedent, and no basis in common sense. The fact that the Supreme Court is even considering says far more about the extremism and diminishing credibility of the court than it does about the merits of the theory. During the exchange of written legal arguments, Republicans have at times suggested the court should overrule major precedents that have favored balance and oversight in redistricting, says Riggs. That includes the right of voters to strike down a redistricting plan through referendum. That was a 1916 case. The power of state governors to veto redistricting maps, 1932 case. And voters' rights to create an independent redistricting commission. That was in Arizona in 2015. And Riggs says the petitioner's brief talks about the history of the elections clause, and they make it seem like this is an unfettered power that the framers gave to the state legislators to the exclusion of all others and ignoring the traditional and historic underpinning of judicial review. SCSJ's defense of voting rights has received broad bipartisan support from lawyers, jurists, scholars, commenters, and others who have filed amicus curiae, or friend of the court, briefs, says Riggs. Notable participants include former California Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and other former Republican officials, the American Bar Association, and the American Civil Liberties Union. The outcome of the case is far from guaranteed, however. Even if the U.S. Supreme Court rules in favor of the respondents, SCSJ and others, battles over redistricting will continue, says Riggs. Whenever we won in a courtroom, those who have been committed to drawing redistricting lines to disempower rather than empower have found new ways. Even if we got that positive outcome, it means we go back to state courts. There will be more work to be done, but at least we will know that state constitutions will do what they're meant to do. The decision of the U.S. court, likely to be released sometime next year, will lean on today's oral arguments, including the exchange of questions and answers between justices and attorneys. Thanks to Trump's appointment of three new justices, the U.S. Supreme Court has a solid 6-3 conservative majority. A ruling in favor of Republicans could have significant consequences for voters, particularly those of color. Riggs says, we've seen black and brown voters being targeted because of their race and for political reasons, and we've seen this justified as it's politics, not race, or we're just complying with the Voting Rights Act. But the Southern strategy is still alive and well, and we, as racial justice advocates, have to continue to call out and name that impact. This is part of a larger story arc of North Carolina voters bucking under the restrictions of redistricting plans that are designed to polarize, separate, limit political power for others, for some, and maximize political power for others. It's part of a build-up to the ultimate question: how do voters get relief when the people that they're electing are redrawing their own lines to secure their own futures? Next, Anne Blythe, column or article in North Carolina Health News, is reprinted in the Indie Week, and it's called A Long Time Coming. 4 weeks after a state Superior Court judge issued a far-reaching ruling ordering North Carolina to deliver services in home settings to people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, the state is appealing that decision. Cody Kinsley, Secretary of the State Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, announced the decision on Wednesday during a briefing with reporters. The case at issue was filed in 2017 in Wake County Superior Court as Samantha R. and Disability Rights North Carolina versus State of North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and Cody Kinsley in his official capacity as Secretary of DHHS. Samantha Roney, now 33, is the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit, accusing the state of not doing enough to provide support to residents with intellectual and developmental disabilities in community settings of their choice. The focus is on the Innovations Waiver. That's a state Medicaid program that gives DHHS leeway to allow people with disabilities to receive care in their homes or community settings. The program, however, is underfunded for the number of people who need services. There are 16,000 more people waiting for such services than state-funded slots available, with a wait list that could extend as long as a decade. On November 2nd, Judge Alan Badur issued a 12-page order in which he gave the state 10 years to move individuals in institutional settings to home-based or community-based services of their choosing, using funding from the Innovations Waiver. Disability rights advocates applauded the decision and described it as a long time coming. DHHS announced plans on Wednesday to challenge the ruling in the State Court of Appeals while also acknowledging that greater strides are necessary to live up to its, quote, commitment of serving individuals with disabilities and supporting them to lead a life that is safe, healthy, and fulfilling. Core to that commitment is our commitment to choice, making sure that individuals with disabilities can live self-directed lives and have opportunities throughout the state and communities to live those lives, and that their families can be supported as well, said Kinsley. Before the lawsuit was filed in 2017, Roney's parents felt compelled to place their intellectually and disabled daughter in the J. Iverson Riddle Development Center in Morganton after being rejected for services they needed to be able to keep her at home with them. That changed as the lawsuit went before Badur, and recently Roney has been able to participate in programs at the Riddle Development Center during the day and sleep in her bed at her own home. That didn't stop the lawsuit, though, from moving ahead in court. Others on the waiver waiting list continue to be compelled to live in institutions, an impediment to care that Disability Rights NC finds acceptable and is willing to continue to fight the obstacle in appeals court. Virginia Marcus, CEO of Disability Rights NC, described Badur's ruling in a statement sent to reporters as, quote, very strong legally and unlikely to be reversed. Kinsley said DHHS worried about a provision in the order that in 6 years ends long-term admissions into intermediate facilities. She said Wednesday, while the department is deeply aligned with many aspects of that decision, I have grave concerns about keeping pieces of that decision that would limit choice for individuals and potentially push over 1,000, if not more, individuals in small community-based homes and other spaces out of those stable environments that their family members and they rely on every day in a short period of time. And again, Kinsley is the director of Health Disabilities Department in North Carolina. He outlined steps the department has taken this year to tackle these long-term problems brought to the state's attention by advocates for people with disabilities. In January, the department released its Olmstead Plan for 2022 and 23, which calls for placing at least 3,000 qualified people with disabilities into independent housing. Fulfilling a long-term vision of this Olmstead Plan, according to DHHS, will take annual investments of $150 million. The General Assembly funded an additional 1,000 waiver slots in its most recent spending plan. Additionally, the first-year secretary announced a newer and more ambitious plan, as well as new roles for Kelly Crosby, who will serve as director of the Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse Services, and Renee Rader, who will be deputy director. Kinsley said he had buy-in for more funding from Governor Cooper, and he puts forward a budget proposal early next year. Funding, though, will depend largely on what Republicans leading the state Senate and House of Representatives will support in the coming budget cycle. Kinsley hopes to persuade lawmakers of the importance of doing more for people with disabilities. Quote, "This plan has been formed by careful conversations with individuals with disabilities, family members, and stakeholders from all across the state that we've been hearing from incredibly loudly over the last month and longer. These conversations are critical and important in working with people to build a North Carolina together that we want to be different. It is critical for all of us and is going to take all of us to get it done." Disability Rights NC was not at the table for the creation of that vision, according to Corey Dunn, Director of Public Policy for the organization. Knowlton Marcus, the CEO, lamented the state's unwillingness to try to craft a settlement or joint motion for Badur to consider that would have gotten to the heart of the DHHS concerns expressed by Kinsley. Knowlton Marcus said in her statement, "Many people in our community have spent valuable time and effort in good faith attempts to help move the state to action. The Samantha R. decision was our vision made reality, and we will not give up the fight. DHHS has failed to cooperate with this process, refusing to engage in planning or negotiation, failing to offer milestones or benchmarks they could meet, and now appealing the court order, delaying justice for North Carolinians with IDD even longer." Tomasi McDonald from Durham has this personal reflection on an individual in Durham, Marlon Williams, a beloved fixture of the city, downtown bar scene. "The world needs more bar characters," she writes. Marlon Arrington Williams, with his trademark flowing gray whiskers, owlish Windsor glasses, and an easygoing gap-tooth grin, was an habitué at a handful of bars in Durham's downtown district. He often sat at the end of a bar counter, sipping from a glass of his favorite beer or whiskey while reading or watching soap operas that he loved. The more polished spots like Kingfisher, Unscripted, and the Poor House weren't his scene. He preferred rustic, dark paneled rooms with dim lighting and a pub-like ambience served up at the Accordion Club, Bull McCabe's, 106 Main, Bull City Burger and Brewery, and the James Joyce. It seems almost prescient now. On a warm, sunny, early Monday afternoon, before Thanksgiving, Williams, a normally reserved and quiet man, was the body electric while holding court at the Dive Bar Accordion, grinning like he'd gotten away with something, which we will soon see he had. Williams stood in the middle of the bar with his right arm draped around a bartender while singing Journey's 1983 hit, Separate Ways. Shoot, he even did a little soft shoe dance and played the air guitar. "Someday some will find you, break those chains that bind you. One night will remind you how we touched and went our separate ways." The next night, on November the 22nd, Williams returned to Accordion. It was just after 9 p.m. when he collapsed and died while talking to a bartender. He was 62. Juliet Cash, an accordion bartender who was working the Monday when Williams sang One Last Take, said, "Isn't that crazy that he would sing that song?" Before arriving for his ultimate last round at accordion, Williams had stopped by the James Joyce on Main Street for dinner around 7. Pete Bolduc, who was working behind the James Joyce bar, told Indy he and a friend split the sandwich. He went to the accordion for a nightcap. Bolduc could only shake his head, thinking about the trauma endured by accordion workers who saw what happened to Williams. "I have a bad night," he says. "If there's a fight or someone throws up, it's hard to process. It's just so unreal to see someone at night in relative perfect health and wake up the next morning and they're gone." Williams' cause of death has not officially been made public. The day after Williams died, the accordion was closed. One of the bartenders told Indy, "We never close, but we closed for that one." Accordion workers weren't the only ones shaken by Williams' death. A goodly number of bartenders and barflies alike in the downtown district were shocked and saddened by the news of Williams' passing. My friend and fellow journalist Eric Tullis currently bartends at Unscripted, but poured many a draft for Williams while working at the old Whiskey and Criterion bars. He texted me the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, "Marlon had a heart attack last night at the accordion." I called him immediately. "How is he?" "He's dead," Tullis answered. Over at 106 Main, there's an empty chair where Williams used to sit near the end of the bar. Three bouquets of flowers in glass vases sit atop the section of the bar where he would be, hunched over a drink and a newspaper. Several glass-encased burning candles are on one side of the flowers. Two empty shot glasses and an unopened orange and gray can of Williams' favorite beer, Bell's Two-Hearted Ale, sit on the other. There's a small gold-plated plaque about the size of a business card on the counter. It reads, "Forever Corporate, Marlon A. Williams, the Academy thanks you." Alice Leslie, a bartender at 106 Main, says William was known as Corporate because he was one of the bar's first customers when it opened several years ago. Leslie explains about how the staff humorously dealt with minor issues if Williams was seated at the bar. "We would say, talk to Corporate." It was one of those 106 inside jokes. The 106 Main staff also put out a yellow legal pad with thoughts of Marlon scrawled across the top for bar patrons to sign. As of Monday, more than 35 people had written tributes. Someone wrote, "I will miss your laugh. Your witness, you strength, you sexy mother. Rest in peace. What will NFL Sundays at 106 be like without you now? Miss you already. Marlon, you were kind. You spoke to me like I was a person and not a stereotype." Marlon Arrington Williams was born in 1960. He was a descendant of one of Cary's most prominent and pioneering families of overachievers, dating back to the antebellum South. Williams' great-grandfather, Alfred Arrington, was the son of an enslaver on a plantation in Warren County. He was freed before the Civil War and came to Cary during the late 1860s. Alfred and his son Arch were large landowners in north central Cary, according to the Friends of Page Walker website. That website notes that William's grandfather Arch Arrington Jr. organized an effort to build a new school for black children in 1937 after the Cary Colored School near the present day Cary Elementary burned down. William's uncle, Gorlett Arrington, donated land to the Wake County Public School System for the school. It went on to become Kingswood Elementary. William's family could not be reached for comment, and the Indy found scant information about his father. Williams was the only child of Ella Arrington Williams Vinson, a Wake County Public Elementary School teacher and author of Both Sides of the Tracks, two volumes chronicling Carrie's racial history. She taught for more than three decades and died in 2013. After graduating from high school, Williams earned an undergraduate degree in economics from Notre Dame. In 1982, an official with the school's registrar's office told the Indy, Williams earned a law degree from the UNC Chapel Hill School of Law, according to the website lawyers.com. Williams hadn't lost a case in nearly 20 years, but that's because he hadn't represented anyone in nearly 20 years, according to the state bar associations in California and North Carolina. He was admitted to the state bar in 1987 in California, but his license to practice law was suspended after he failed to pay his bar fees. He had an online presence that indicated he operated a law office on West Trinity Street, but his name or status as an attorney does not appear during a search of the bar association. Nor does he appear in a search for paralegals on the Bar Association's website. Leslie, the bartender at 106 Main, said he didn't have an office. He did title searches and that sort of thing. He did not litigate. Bolduc at James Joyce wasn't sure if Williams would pass the bar. I know he was a paralegal. Maybe he was an attorney. He would come in here and do a bunch of briefs and technical writing. Cash at Accordion said he often brought his work here. Sometimes he would finish beforehand, but if not, he'd bring it here. But even if he ran into financial difficulties that pretty much flatlined his status with the state bar for nearly two decades, those who served him drinks and food while exchanging heaping slices of good-natured banter could care less. They don't measure him by whether he'd passed the state bar, but by the largeness of his heart that he shared while sitting at their bar counters. The downtown bartenders who served Williams fondly remember a quick-witted, very direct person who didn't mince words. Leslie said he was highly intelligent, very observant, and capable of being very, very silly, adding, he would come in and watch the soap operas on his phone at the TV. He would watch Young and Restless, Bold and Beautiful. Sometimes he would watch soaps at Accordion. The Young and Restless came on at 12:30, and the Bold and Beautiful came on right after that, said Cash. He'd watch them back to back. Cash adds that Williams was a very private person. A mutual friend, Alan Red, agreed. He was a tough old nut to crack. Taj Sneed, the front house manager at Bull City Burger and Brewery on Paris Street, told Indy that Williams would drop by every once in a while and have a seat at the end of the bar. Sneed said he would read. He'd bring a newspaper or book and order a burger and a beer. Cash says the week before Williams died, he arrived at Accordion soon after the start of her shift at 11 a.m. He drank all day, she says, and kept making song requests. I told him I would play whatever he wanted me to play. He loved Talking Heads and Journey. He was drinking Narragansett that week. Long before that fateful Tuesday night at Accordion, Williams had easily passed the highest bar of all. People genuinely cared about him. Someone wrote at that yellow pad at 106 Main, Marlon, I've seen your smile for years, and it always lit up a room. So many people love you. That concludes the article, but a sideline says there will be a memorial service for Mr. Williams. It will take place at 12 p.m. Saturday, December the 10th, at the Berthy Funeral Chapel. That's on 1510 Fayetteville Street. A celebration of his life will take place at the Accordion Club immediately following the service. Again, 12 p.m. noon, Saturday, December 10th, Berthy Funeral Chapel on Fayetteville Street. All right, and let's move on to music. I have a bit of time left. Brian Howe has an article about Mimi Luce, L-U-S-E. A late bloomer in post-punk, Mimi Luce is making up for lost time with an exhilarating turn to industrial techno as permanent. Mimi Luce was a teenage deadhead. Many a weekend in her native Connecticut, we find her camping at festivals. She didn't play music, but she was a fan, to put it mildly. It was the early 2000s, and she was heavily into the jam band and classic rock tape trading scene. She read every book on 60s counterculture the library had and began sewing her own clothes on her sewing machine, all corduroy, patchwork, and embroidery. "I was a hippie," she says, now 38. Sitting next to the second-hand machines she started using much more recently to stitch samples onto bass and drums, "I was really trying to create my own culture." Arriving home from her job as the events manager at Nasher Museum of Art, Luce was wearing a bright lime green sweater and a dark skirt, and their sharp contrast was somehow like the one between her polished, easy manner and the tarnished, intense music that she makes. But many scarlet begonias fell between the dead and DAF, the pioneering German new wave band that stands tall, clad in black patent leather, among the influences that turned Luce from the post-punk of her first band, Cochon, to the industrial techno of her solo project, Permanent, which, after sprouting late, is blooming quickly. Luce discovered punk near the end of high school at an art camp in Boston, where she encountered the scorn of New York kids who liked Minor Threat. It was a musical big bang that sped up at McGill University, where she went to study English and art history with the intention of becoming an arts writer. She plunged into Montreal's vibrant scene as the culture editor of the McGill Daily, a storied student newspaper. She was going to DIY spaces and warehouse shows, getting into genres like electroclash, no wave, and noise. "Still," she says, "music seemed like a thing only cool people did, and I didn't feel that cool. I was a writer, a cultural commentator. I saw myself more as an observer." After college, she spent a few years in New York, working for an art auction house while writing for magazines like Art in America and Frieze, F-R-I-E-Z-E. Then she took a year to apply to graduate schools while living with her French grandmother in Paris and working at a mattress store. In 2011, she got into Duke for an art history Ph.D. Her focus? A moment in early 20th century France when art historians and journalists rejected modernism. A key principle that, in the scope of her music now, emphasizes the interplay of art, culture, and lived experience. But then, she was becoming a chronicler of chroniclers, and music was fading into the background. The years between 2015, when she was leaning into her dissertation, and 2019, when she defended it, were a blur. She moved to Paris, then Durham, then Paris, Durham, Amsterdam, Paris, Durham. Somewhere in the middle of Paris, something woke up. She says, "That's when I really started living again. I think being embodied, going to clubs and meeting musicians and artists." She'd taken a girls' rock class on bass before leaving Durham, which was mind-blowing, and felt inspired by all the women she knew who were starting bands, like Fitness Women and Silent Lunch. She auditioned to play in a Parisian post-punk band using her limited experience to laboriously learn the songs and was crushed when she didn't get in. "But that's how I learned to play music," she says. "I was like, now I know how to play. I'm not good enough to be in this band that's going on tour, but I can start my own band." In 2017, Luce and Patricia Bass, a drummer in her cohort, started writing demos. Luce sang in French, finding poetic interest in her uneven command of that language. They were first called ODV. That's a Duchampian pun that's as hard to explain as the band's final name, Cochon, which gives a horrible term a feminist flip. "Like, I can't tell my French family the band's name because it's deeply offensive," she says with a breezy laugh. Back in Durham, Marielle Dutoit joined on guitar and Carla Hung on keyboards. Hannah Spector and Jeff Schilling successively drummed. Later, Dave Rodriguez played bass and synths. Steeped in No New York and Lizzie Mercer Declou, Cochon's music could suggest a lost Rough Trade demo from 1982. They dropped spoons like The Slits and sprayed aerosols like Joy Division. Luce says, but it was never pastiche. It always came from sincere appreciation of contemporary bands I listen to and female-led post-punk bands I read old Maximum Rock and Roll reviews about. Cochon played a few shows, but it was primarily a songwriting and recording project, producing a self-titled pink tape in 2019 and a 12-inch record, Emergency, in 2021. Meanwhile, Luce found herself thinking more and more about people and places. She says, to me, electronic music and the spaces it creates are like a continuation of the project of modernity. In the sense that you're dissolving art into life, you're not a passive viewer. And that was the whole point of Dada, futurism, and surrealism. You're making reality weirder, but the audience is participating. She got some gear, effects pedals, a Roland groove box sequencer from a musician friend at Duke, Yair Rubinstein, who also gave her a crash course in approximating her industrial idols, Esplendor Geometrico, Chris and Cozy, DAF. She was learning kit drums and layering bass and synths on top. After one tape of Sonic Collage as Manhole, she started permanent early in the pandemic, beginning to amass a magpie's empire of eclectic samples, pitched down, wine glass tones, ASMR, horror movies, Seneca, and The Real Housewife. Well, John Feddersen has run out of time to finish reading, and cannot finish reading Indie Week or The Independent, and I just invite you to go online if you want to see the remainder of that article and several other articles in this publication at indieweek.com. That's your best choice. And if you want to hear this interview or this article, that's the where to go. The rest of this issue that I'm just finished reading is available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. And thank you very much from John Feddersen, saying so long.